You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders is published by the American Psychiatric Association and provides standard criteria for the classification of mental disorders. The publication of the new DSM-5 this spring has sparked concern amongst mental health professionals who are calling into question its safety and scientific rigor. For the last 2 years, there have been repeated calls for an external review of the DSM-5. The International DSM-5 Response Committee wrote an open letter on the DSM-5, which has been endorsed by over 50 mental health organizations and signed by 15,000 people, primarily mental health professionals. I'm joined by Brent Dean Robbins, who is President-elect, Division 32 of the Society for Humanistic Psychology, and Director of Psychology and Associate Professor at Point Park University. He's co-chair of the International DSM-5 Response Committee. Hello, good morning, Brent.
Good morning.
What is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders used for, and how pervasive is its influence?
The DSM-5 is produced by the American Psychiatric Association through a very large task force of mental health professionals and scientists, and it has a very large influence. The DSM in general has a very large influence over diagnosis, especially here in the United States, even more so than internationally, although it has an influence across the world. I mean, it even has an impact on the international diagnostic codes, because there has tended to be historically a collaboration between the DSM diagnosis and the ICD system, which is the international diagnostic code.
Probably anybody who's had contact with the mental health system has heard of the DSM. It's obviously used by practitioners. Who else uses it?
Practitioners use it. Researchers use it. It's used in the court of law. Attorneys use it. It can be used in the cases of disability claims. In various government agencies, so it's used by a lot of different professionals.
So, what has been the process so far to develop the DSM-5, or I should say, what process has been used because it's now been launched?
Mm-hmm. The process is a matter of bringing together the American Psychiatric Association brings together a chair who through essentially committees. Get together and organize task forces that are assigned to specific diagnostic categories. And they get together, and based on their review of the literature, they decide on what stays and what gets changed from one edition of the manual to another. So this has been years in the making. The last diagnostic manual came out over 20 years ago. So this is an interesting change with the new DSM-5. They've changed from Roman numerals to Arabic numeral, and part of the reason for that is because they want to, similar to software systems, they want to be able to do a 5.1, 5.2, and update the manual continuously as needed. The implication of that, though, is that the structure of the model would essentially remain the same, but there would be adjustments over time.
Now, I mentioned that there had been calls for external review. I guess that's something that I would expect, that such an important and influential document would receive. Why hasn't it received external review?
That's a really good question. We asked for external review, and as you mentioned, many signatories, both professional organizations, mental health professions, professional mental health organizations, I should say, in the United States and abroad, over 50 of them, and lots of individuals, mainly mental health professionals, signed that petition, the open letter to the DSM-5, asking for an external review. And we did get a letter back from the American Psychiatric Association, which said that they would not go forward with that external review. And the reason for that they gave us is that they didn't think that anyone was capable, other than them, of providing a review of their document.
The International Response Committee says the DSM includes many diagnostic categories with questionable reliability, which may lead to misleading assumptions about their scientific validity. What are your concerns?
The concern is that, you know, there is a originally when the DSM was developed, it wasn't used in a way that was quite as pervasive as it is today. But there was a real big change with the third edition of the DSM. You know, prior to the publication of the DSM Volume 3 in 1980, psychiatric diagnosis was criticized because it had really bad reliability. Reliability means that when two or more clinicians meet the same patient, they're not agreeing on the same diagnosis using the criteria of the DSM. So because of that substandard reliability, there was major effort to make a change with the third edition of the DSM to improve inter-rater reliability. And that was successful in the sense that inter-rater reliability did get better. However, with the clinical trials with the DSM-5, the reliability coefficients, what you call the kappa values, actually have gone down. So the current DSM-5, instead of improving reliability over time, it's actually gotten worse across diagnostic categories. And many of the diagnostic categories have kappa levels that are below just universally acceptable standards for reliability. This is a major problem, not only clinically, but also in research, because whenever you're doing research studies, it's really, really important that you have reliability, because if your raters can't agree on what they're seeing with a particular patient, what the diagnosis is, then your scientific results are going to be questionable at best, and it harms the validity of your research. You're not sure what your research means, what the findings mean. And so because of that, I think that's why we see, you know, the National Institute of Mental Health now backing off of the DSM, using DSM for research purposes. So the National Institute for Mental Health here in the United States, which is the leading institution funding research in mental health, is no longer going to be using the DSM for research purposes.
Now, I understand, Brent, one of the key concerns also relates to lowering the thresholds of symptoms or behaviors that trigger a diagnosis. Why is that a problem, that lowering of those thresholds?
The concern about the lowering of diagnostic thresholds is that when you sort of loosen the requirements for diagnosing someone with a mental disorder, there's always a risk that you are going to take people that are having normal transient crises in their life that would sort of resolve on their own and wouldn't really require medical intervention. They would then sort of get captured under the diagnostic category, and that might mean that they would then get diagnosed with a medical condition that could follow them for the rest of their lives. And it could also mean that they might get treatments, which can be very helpful for people who have that disorder. But if they don't need that intervention, there can be harmful consequences, because there's always risks in any kind of medical intervention. There's great benefits, but you know, there's side effects. For example, if somebody were to be misdiagnosed with certain disorders, they might get treated, for example, with atypical antipsychotic drugs, which are one of the fastest growing psychiatric medications on the market right now. And they can be very helpful for somebody who really needs them, but if somebody gets them and they don't really need them, then they would be put at unnecessary risk, because those drugs have pretty severe side effects in many cases. They can cause irreversible motor disorders. They can cause, there's some recent research that's come out looking at magnetic resonance imaging in the brains of schizophrenics who use those drugs, and it can cause degeneration of the brain over time. It can lead to increased risk of diabetes and obesity. Many of these classes of drugs can increase, this particular class of drugs can make people rapidly gain weight, sometimes, in some cases, as much as 20% of their weight within a matter of months. So that's just one category of drugs. But, you know, antidepressants can cause sexual dysfunction and other side effects. So if somebody doesn't need those drugs, if they could recover on their own or with a less intrusive intervention, maybe some support through a period of crisis, for example, that would be preferable for a number of different reasons. One, because once a person begins to identify with a psychiatric label, that becomes a part of their record, and it also can change how people understand their condition. You know, they begin to see themselves as a person who has a medical problem, and when maybe they don't. And in the case of medical, the other thing I should mention about that is, you know, there is really, it's hard to find really good psychiatrists these days. They're in high demand. In the office where I work, there are psychiatrists who have month-long waiting lists, and pediatric psychologists are even harder to find. I think, you know, there's several hundred children with mental disorders for every single pediatric psychiatrist. So what's often happening is because people can't get in to see their psychiatrist, they're going to their general physician. And notoriously, general physicians, because they have to be abreast of a wide variety of medical conditions, they don't have the specialization in psychiatry that psychiatrists do. So their diagnoses are less reliable than someone who has much more training in that area. So there's a tendency to have a lot of misdiagnosis and overdiagnosis when you have a general physician doing the diagnosis. So when you have a lot of people seeking out psychiatric care who don't really need it, often what happens is the people who really do need that psychiatric care get squeezed out, because oftentimes those are the people who have the most difficult time getting to the doctor, or maybe they lack resources. So the people who are sort of on the edge of the new diagnostic category where they may not really need that care are sort of taking up resources of the people who really need it.
I want to pick up on a point that you made about the increasing diagnosis and also potential misdiagnosis of people with psychiatric disorders by general practitioners who aren't specialized in that area. Does that then have a knock-on effect of people potentially taking more pharmaceuticals to treat those things that may be not the best course of treatment for them?
Yeah, that's right. That's what I was suggesting earlier, is that, you know, if somebody starts taking a medication, if they go to a general physician who maybe isn't as very well trained to distinguish between, you know, someone who really needs some kind of medical intervention and someone who doesn't, and they're relying on DSM-5 categories that have less than desirable reliability, and in other words, they're not clearly distinguishing between normality and pathology, then people are likely to be put on medication they don't need, especially if you realize that there's direct-to-consumer marketing by pharmaceuticals. So the pharmaceutical companies are advertising on television, in magazines, and all over the place. So people will hear those advertisements, and they might think, wow, that kind of sort of sounds like some of the problems I've been having. I'm going to go into a doctor. And oftentimes if they go to a general physician and they say, you know, I saw an ad for drug X and it sounds like I might have those symptoms, a general practitioner might be more inclined to provide that medication because they don't have the training to clearly say to that person, well, you know, yeah, it's sort of, when you heard that advertisement, it sounded similar to the symptoms you have, but your symptoms aren't at the level of severity that would require this type of medical intervention. And by the way, there are these side effects with this medication that you could take. So it might be better to try some other interventions, less intrusive interventions first, to see if this resolves itself without having to use, you know, a more intrusive and potentially side effect inducing treatment.
The International DSM-5 Response Committee, which you're the co-chair of, is recommending, and I'm going to quote from your statement of concern, clinicians, researchers, journal editors, healthcare planners, managers, and commissioners, the pharmaceutical industry, and the media should avoid the use of the DSM-5 wherever possible. Is the DSM-5 reformable?
I think it's potentially reformable. I think that there are differences of opinion along these lines about how to move forward we've put together, the Society for Humanistic Psychology, as a follow-up to the open letter, has also developed a committee called the International Diagnostic Summit Committee, and we have a website, dxsummit.org, which is to gather people together who are experts at diagnosis to talk about, okay, what's the future of diagnosis? I think there's a general sense that the DSM-5 is less than desirable, even among the insiders. You know, I hear from people who are task force members that, okay, this is what we have, but we, you know, even David Kupner, who's the chair of the DSM-5, when the National Institute of Mental Health came forward and said, you know, this is really not a scientifically valid diagnostic system, Kupner said, okay, it's not perfect, but it's what we have now, and so we have to, you know, this is the best we have that's available. That was, you know, that's essentially what his answer was. So it's the kind of thing where, well, this is what we have. We're going to have to live with it for now until we come up with something better. So the question is, how do we go forward from here? One approach, and I think that's endorsed by the former chair of the DSM-4, Alan Francis, is to really go back, you know, to base the DSM on better science and not to rush forward with diagnostic categories that aren't well-researched, like they have with the DSM-5. So, for example, there's a new research there's a new diagnostic category called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, and you know, the DMDD. And DMDD is, you know, it hasn't really been studied very extensively, except within one or two laboratories. And to put that into the manual at this point in time, without it having more time for research investigation, according to Francis, is, you know, destructive. And so he's arguing for staying with a DSM type of approach, but being more conservative. And then there's someone like a Peter Kinderman, and I'm inclined to agree with him, who's with the British Psychological Society, who is saying, let's move forward with, starting over from a new foundation. And he's arguing for a problem-based approach to diagnosis, which is something that's still being conceptualized and more clearly articulated. A lot of those discussions are happening at dxsummit.org. But essentially it means, rather than assuming that a collection of symptoms represent a syndrome that have an underlying common cause, you would use a process of describing descriptively and empirically the problem that is seen in the room with the patient, and then using a case formulation approach. So then you don't have to sort of take an inferential leap to this abstract category of a diagnosis like schizophrenia or like attention deficit disorder. You're saying somebody comes in and they have an auditory hallucination problem and they have a paranoid delusion problem, then you can say, okay, well, let's investigate the person's history. Let's see what might be some causal antecedents. It could, you know, cases of auditory hallucination, it could be a tumor. It could be seizures, you know, temporal lobe seizures. It could be trauma. It could be that the person has had early developmental history of trauma, and they're having auditory hallucinations that are the voice of their abuser, as we've seen in certain cases. All three of those cases are very different. So leaping to the label of schizophrenia doesn't add any value to a description of those problems. It doesn't provide an explanation of those problems. It just provides, you know, an abstract label that sort of designates those problems as problems that tend to occur together. So a problem-based approach is, I think, likely to lead to a more reliable and therefore more valid and therefore more scientific approach to diagnosis. But that still has to be investigated. And I know Peter Kinderman, and I'm hoping to join with him and other people are, to actually test that out, to look at a DSM-5 approach and look at a problem-based approach and see which is more reliable and valid in practice.
I really appreciate your joining us this morning. It's been really interesting.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your giving me an opportunity to talk about these very important issues. They impact the lives of a lot of different people.
I've been speaking with Brent Dean Robbins. He is co-chair of the International DSM-5 Response Committee.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.com. www.redeyecollective.org.